The second hour of Galesburg Live is on the air on this Saturday morning. I'm Will Stevenson. Again, now part of the rotating cast of characters, if you will, that host Galesburg Live every Saturday morning, and very glad to be. And in my inaugural program, in our inaugural second hour of this program, I'm pleased to be joined for the hour by, for the purposes of this discussion, local attorney Jeremy Carlin. Good morning. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Will, and welcome back to Galesburg. We're happy to have you here.
I am so glad to be back, for sure. And it's been a great time, and hopefully this will be a great time as well. And I wanted to bring you in because we wanted to talk mostly just law and legal questions
here. Well, you know, I'll come in here having to wear so many different hats. it's nice to have my day gig.
I don't know what any of those hats are, I swear.
All right.
Now, and in these days, you're with which firm?
I'm with Barash and Everett. Okay. Here in Galesburg. It's a kind of funny story. When I went into private practice from the state's attorney's office, I joined, at that point, was Barash and Storzbach.
Yeah,
and,
okay.
And that was 20-some-odd years ago. And left that firm, started my own firm. And then I've come full circle back to Barash.
And I wanted to start with sort of that background type of a thing first. But before I do, we are willing, and Jeremy's willing to take questions this hour. So as if you have a legal question, obviously you should consult your own attorney. But if there's a broad sense that we can try to answer here, we'll certainly do that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously, I am a lawyer, so I have to kind of put down some of the legal fine print, which is that, you know, we're not forming a legal relationship, an attorney-client privilege here. Obviously, what you say on the radio is not privileged, but happy to answer the questions to the best that I can.
And our number is 342-9194 if you have a question. Again, 342-9194. We'll take those throughout the hour as they come in. One other note, we're using a delay here, so turn your radio down if you get on the air. So make a note of that, if you will. So let's, again, you mentioned it a little bit here, Jeremy, but let's start at the beginning. Probably because one of my favorite movies is Blazing Saddles. If I can paraphrase that a little bit, what's a dazzling urbanite like you doing in a rustic setting like this?
Well, thank you. Well, you know, after I graduated law school from Loyola of Chicago in 1994 and went to Milwaukee, where I did labor and employment law representing management. And the firm I was with, they broke every promise they made to me except my salary. And it was a terrible gig.
Wait, lawyers break promises to people,
Jeremy? I know. Go figure. You know, I thought that's the kind of work that I wanted to do, and it really wasn't. We represented small to medium-sized businesses, and particularly – what it was helping them terminate their bad employees who happened to also be in protected classes. Okay. And so guarding them against lawsuit. And, you know, I'm surprised they don't write more folk songs about that. But nonetheless, that's what I did. And it was a drag. And I thought I made a complete mistake about going into the law. You know, I had a contract in hand to go teach English in South Korea.
No kidding.
Basically run off and join the circus. And I went back to my law school career services. Thank goodness I did. And they said to me, you know, Jeremy, you know, you want to be in a courtroom on a daily basis. You're that kind of lawyer. Being stuck behind a desk is not what you need to do. And in order to do that, then, you know, because you have so little experience. I mean, the only way to get courtroom experience as a young attorney is to be a prosecutor or a public defender.
I was going to say, imagine in some aspects of being an attorney, you almost have to pay your dues, don't you, before you have to get to. It sounds like that's kind of what you're telling me here. You're in a lousy law firm, but you needed to have that experience before you could kind of move up to a somewhat bigger time, right?
Well, right. I mean, yeah, you know, I thought that's what I wanted to do, and that kind of law. It's the kind of work that I did during law school. I worked for the Cook County State's Attorney, which is the largest employer in Cook County.
No kidding.
Yeah, right. And I did labor and employment there, and I thought it was interesting, and got out into the private sector, and it wasn't for me. So I applied for a job at small town or small town state's attorney's offices, and I eventually ended up here at Knox County State's Attorney's Office. Ray Kimball hired me in 1995, and I moved here. And you know, I thought I was going to be here just for 2 years. You know, get my legal experience, and then go back to either Chicago or back up to Wisconsin. And then, got some great experience, got a lot of trial experience in the state's attorney's office doing all sorts of types of cases. And then a couple law firms here kind of rushed me and approached me about joining their firms. I ended up with the Brash & Storzbach firm on Cherry Street.
Okay. And you did that for a while, and then you ended up—
I was there for 11 years.
Okay.
And then started up my own firm on Main Street for eight, and I was running that firm for 8 years.
I didn't realize it was that long. It seemed like you were just doing that for a short period.
No, it's for 8 years.
No kidding.
We started in 2008.
Wow.
And now it's what, 2017?
17, yeah.
Right. Left there in 2016. And, you know, the irony is that, you know, when I left law school, I said to myself, you know, I'll do any kind of law, but I don't want to do criminal law and I don't want to do family law.
Well, look at what you're doing now.
Well, it's
right?
About 90% of my practice now, right? And
what kind of happened to sort of change that? I mean, you know, although I joke that, you know, if I were a better DJ, I would be doing that now instead of hosting news programs like this. But
I
imagine just time and practice and need and that sort of thing. I imagine that all played into it.
Sure. Well, I mean, if you're going to go to a state's attorney's office, you have to do criminal law,
right?
And again, you know, what I realized early on in my career was that what I enjoyed was mixing it up in a courtroom. I enjoyed being in front of a judge on a daily basis. I enjoyed speaking on my feet and advocating the positions in a courtroom, advocating either on behalf of the government when I worked for the state's attorney's office or advocating on behalf of clients. And in this area, in this geographic area, and for to do that, you're doing people law.
Yeah.
Corporate law that kind of litigation is usually they settle it. I joke with a friend of mine who's an attorney up in Milwaukee who does franchise work, and he does a lot of litigation. But he rarely sees a jury, you know, and you know, because all those cases tend to settle on the courthouse steps. And, you know, I've done more. I've done about 20 jury trials in my career, that's about 19 more than most lawyers do.
And some of those have been, without naming names, obviously, of those have been pretty high-profile, high-pressure situations.
Right. Illinois no longer has the death penalty, but during my career, I've had 3 death penalty cases. You can name names. I represent Nick Sheely.
Yeah.
In those cases, and those were 3 trials. Yes, those are high pressure, high profile, difficult cases. But handling those cases in which nothing is taken for granted, we examine every aspect of what we're doing with a fine tooth comb. It prepares you to handle less sensational, less difficult work. And so I'm certainly a better lawyer for having done it.
Sure.
Yeah.
One of the questions I hear just as a news reporter and covering court cases most of my career was, I don't think people completely understand, at least in terms of criminal law, the criminal process. Like, somebody gets arrested and immediately they go before a judge, and at first they plead not guilty.
Right.
And people say, oh, how can they do that? How can that person plead not guilty and that sort of thing? But it's more or less, I just have to tell them, it's really just kind of part of the process to make sure that rights are preserved and things like that, right?
That's right. I mean, what I find with most of my clients, and in my 23 years of doing this, my experience has been is that 95% of the people that we deal with in the criminal justice system are guilty, and the state can prove it beyond a reasonable doubt.
Mm-hmm.
3% are guilty, but the state can't prove it, and 2% are actually innocent.
Mm-hmm.
And so for the vast, vast majority of the cases that I deal with, it's not a whodunit. It's not a whether or not they're guilty of the crime. It's what do we do with them? And most of my work is trying to arrive at an appropriate disposition, an appropriate sentence that, you know, from my perspective as a defense attorney, is the minimal sentence as possible. But from a prosecutor's perspective, you know, acknowledges the seriousness of the charge, the criminal history of the defendant, the victim's interests as well. And so that's a lot of what we do.
Mm-hmm.
That involves negotiation, that involves persuasion, it involves all sorts of things, a lot of tools in the toolbox that you need. It involves preparation, maybe some poker skills, perhaps some bluffing. but we take that to what we do, at least in my representation. You know, what I tell my clients is that we come at it from two ways. We come at it, one, we're getting ready from trial. You know, from the beginning, we're getting your case ready for trial. And so then we can negotiate from a position of strength, mm-hmm. saying, listen, if you don't give us what we want, we'll try it. And yeah. And then we can negotiate either with the judge or with the state's attorney's office to figure out what is the best disposition. And ultimately, we do that.
I want to ask you some more questions along those lines, but we need to take a quick break first. We're talking with Attorney Jeremy Carlin, and if you have a question, you can ask us here. You're certainly welcome to by calling 342-9194. We'll take your questions throughout the hour as they come in, and we'll talk about other legal matters as well as Galesburg Live continues on WGIL.
Got a question for our expert? Call 342-9194 or email it to WGIL@WGIL.com. Ask the expert during Galesburg Live on 93.7 FM and 1400 AM WGIL.
8:28 on Galesburg Live on WGIL. I'm Will Stevenson with Attorney Jeremy Carlin, taking your questions at 342-9194. We should have plenty of time for them in the second half hour, but we'll need to take another break here before too long. We've been talking about, I guess you could argue, the first part of your career, which has been basically dealing with either prosecution or defense of criminals by and large.
Right.
Is it difficult being an attorney for someone that, whether they're guilty or innocent, is accused of a crime? And I think of that because I imagine there's got to be times where you think to yourself, oh, yeah, this guy's guilty, but you have to defend him like he's innocent until proven guilty.
Sure. You know, yeah, that's a question I get a lot of, and you know, and I try not to say that I'm defending the actions of the individual.
Yeah.
I mean, that would be a tall order, and certainly not something I would want to try to do. But you know, it is a part of defending the system,
mm-hmm.
that the same system in which seems to drag on. And you know, those people who say, oh my gosh, he's guilty, you know, why is it taking forever? It's the same system that protects those individuals who are innocent and have been haven't been accused wrongly. And, you know, the system isn't perfect, of course, it has, you know, but it's the best one that we know at this time. And, but, you know, the people I deal with, you know, I joke, you know, people ask me, you know, which is better, criminal law or family law? And, you know, I say it's criminal law because with criminal law, when I deal with my clients, they're generally you know, bad to marginal people maybe, you know, or good, but they're at their very best and very most polite and cooperative. In divorce work, it's generally good to marginal people, but at their worst and pettiest. you know, with that said, you know, people find themselves in the criminal justice system for a lot of reasons.
Yeah.
And it's not because they're evil or scofflaws or, you know, or malevolent or whatever. It has to do with a lot of the problems in their life, be either poverty or mental health issues, drug abuse. So you take the individual who's before you and you try to treat them with compassion, with some humanity, and so that whatever it is that we do, however the case results, that we try to give individuals the tools with which to not come back to court. And we treat them like humans. There's so many cases in the system. It's easy to be, you know, it's easy to be mechanical about it and treat it like an assembly line. But I genuinely feel that throughout in the way I represent people, if you treat them like maybe your friend, if you treat them with compassion, with some empathy, and try to gain some understanding about why we are there in the first place, that we can get go a long way to try to prevent crime in the future. And I think I tried to do that as a prosecutor, while certainly trying to be aggressive and punish crime.
That's going to be a tough balance if you're on the prosecutor's side, being having some form of compassion, but wanting a jury to know, say that this dude's a bad dude.
Well, treating cases and treating defendants with compassion doesn't mean that means you're being easy. I mean, all of us as parents know that sometimes tough love is necessary, right? You're not necessarily your child's friend; you're a parent, and tough love when it came as a prosecutor is as important. Mm-hmm. But it's also you need to be human. A defendant is charged with their fourth. Possession of controlled substances case. We've sent them to prison before. That has not worked. What are we going to do? You mean going to send them to prison for longer? I mean, sometimes that is what we need to do. But sometimes we need to look at this man or woman and say, what we have done thus far has not helped you and has not gotten you to a place where with effort you can solve your problem. And that's why we look at alternatives like drug court and hardcore probation.
So I guess to kind of sum up this part of our discussion, as the old saying really goes, and I guess there really is a lot of truth to it, you would want the same rights afforded to you if you were accused.
No matter where you are in the case, no matter what side you are, you want to treat people the way that you wish would be treated yourself.
Right. All right. On that note, you mentioned family law there and that sort of thing. We want to focus on some issues related to that on the other side of the break. But if you have a question for Jeremy Carlin, the attorney, not Jeremy Carlin, the everything else you do.
Right. Chief bottle washer.
Yeah, exactly. 342-9194 is our number, and we'll take your questions here in our next half hour. But first, we need to check local news, weather, and sports. It is 8:33 on Galesburg Live on WGIL. Thanks for joining us this morning. The great thing about my job is that sometimes a discussion off the air is just as good as the one on the air.
But right.
That's probably another discussion for another day. This is Galesburg Live on 93.7 FM and 1400 AM WGIL. I'm Will Stevenson, your host this week, and you hear Jeremy Carlin in his day job as a local attorney today. Of course, he's an alderman and is involved in the community in a truckload of ways, which I imagine, just kind of as an aside, is that as beneficial, being an alderman and being and doing the other things you do? Is that as beneficial as being an attorney, but maybe in a different way?
Beneficial to my law practice, or
just you as a person? I mean, fulfilling a void maybe that maybe you didn't even know you had.
Well, right, because I have so much trouble filling the time. I think because of the job that I do as a lawyer, trying to solve problems, being civically active, maybe because of faith in Judaism, there's a strong social justice component to my faith. It does kind of lend itself to being involved in the community. And being an alderman for the last 6 years has been very fulfilling. People ask me, Jeremy, you're going to run again. And,
don't break any news here.
I'm not breaking any news this morning, but when I leave that for another time.
There you
but
go.
It's been a great way to really know my community and be able to help people out in big ways and in little ways. And, it's been a great, great job. It's been very fulfilling.
Absolutely. If you have questions for Jeremy Carlin, the attorney, 342-9194 is the number to call. Again, we'll go through all the disclaimers again later. Just know that if you're going to call in with a question, please remember to turn down your radio. That'll help quite a bit. We did have a question off the air that didn't want to go on that we'll talk about very quickly before another issue you wanted to get into here. A question about the former Aldi's property at Main and Henderson there. It's been for sale. It's been that way since Aldi's moved to Seminary Square. there's supposedly a requirement with that for whoever buys it that it not be used as a grocery store. That's a talk a little bit about that ruling and it, while as unusual as it sounds to me, it's not all that unusual, I'm gathering, as a restriction for putting on a piece of property like that.
Right. I mean, there's two ways that what we're talking about is an agreement of the next seller to the buyer not to engage in a business that competes with Aldi. And as you can imagine, Aldi wants as little competition as possible. They want as much market share. And so preventing their old property from engaging in that business, they can do it either two ways, which is they can have as a part of the contract of sale with the next buyers and prohibiting the buyers from doing that. The way that would work is if that's what happened, then the next buyer could turn around and sell it, and you know, with any restrictions or not.
Mm-hmm.
They could turn it around and perhaps sell it to someone else, and then they could perhaps engage in the business. But on the other hand, then sometimes the way to ensure that the property is perhaps never used for it to be in the retail grocery business is to put a restrictive covenant on it.
And that's what's in place here.
To be honest, I don't know.
Let's just say, let's assume that that's what's in place here.
Let's assume that's the case. Then, you know, into perpetuity, that restrictive covenant could last. I think there are ways to get rid of them through court action.
I was going to say, is there a way if you really want that property and you really want to do something with it that's otherwise restricted, can you negotiate something like that out if you really wanted it?
I think there are also ways to go to court and have them removed as well. As you can imagine, over the years in other communities, there have been restrictive covenants that say that it can't be sold to African property. Can't be sold to African Americans, or other illegal covenants that have been removed. And I believe that over the years, other restrictive covenants can be challenged and removed. It's a difficult process, of course.
Okay, all right. That's the short version on that. Some other non. We spent a lot of time talking about criminal matters, and now we've kind of moved into the non-criminal section of our legal talk today.
Sure.
You were telling me off the air before we started, and boy, I could imagine opening up a can of worms when I say something like family law.
Well, right.
But that's an area of law that's constantly changing, from what I gather.
Yes, it is. If you think about something that touches nearly every – either yourself or everyone has someone who's been in this situation where we're talking about either a divorce or having children out of marriage dealing with the issues that are surrounding that, they of course are highly emotional. They are difficult. They are financial. It is more difficult for two people to live separately than it is to live together. How do we arrange for for decisions to be made for children, as well as how do we decide where they're going to live and where they go to school? These are issues that are again highly emotional and. It's a lot of what I do. And we had the divorce law, the Divorce Act went into place, I think it was 1970-something, and we've had that statute for, 40-some-odd years. Mm-hmm. And very recently, the Divorce Act has changed. And it was a three-step process. We dealt with three different parts of the law that has changed. The first one was the maintenance law, what we used to call alimony.
Mm-hmm.
Now we call it spousal maintenance. The second part was custody or visitation. You know, I used to joke with my clients that, when I talk about, words like custody or visitation, I feel like I'm visiting a relative in prison. not talking about our children. Maybe I said that enough, that the Illinois legislature agreed with me, and now we start talking about allocation of parental responsibilities.
Are you suggesting that you single-handedly may have changed Illinois law, Jeremy?
I guess I am, aren't I? But, you know, enough people have felt the same way that I did. And what we're talking, and again, leave it to lawyers to come up with an innocuous way of talking about these issues. But allocation of parental responsibilities, because ultimately we are dealing with, when it comes to your children and two parents trying to decide what happens to them at post-relationship, we are talking about really just two things, which is how do decisions get made for these children and where will they be when? And if we talk about it in that way,
yeah,
as opposed to talking about it like, I want custody or, you know, if I had a dollar for every time someone came to my office and said, I want custody of my kids.
You wouldn't need to be in practice anymore.
You know, we'd be having this interview in Key West, but,
yeah.
or maybe you'd be here and I'd be on the phone, but,
perhaps,
it's the next question, which is like when I would say, well, what does that mean? What does that mean to you that we get behind that demand for custody? And more often than not, people want to just be able to know what's happening with their children and have some opportunity to influence that.
Is it a hard thing to try to tell some people when they come in and to talk about custody issues that, you know, it's not really about you, it's about the welfare of your kids?
Well, it's not hard to say it, but it's hard sometimes
for people to believe it.
Yeah. What I tell people more often than not is that when you were married, when you were together, decisions got made.
Yeah.
No matter what it says in a piece of paper afterwards, the reality is that you're not going to alter the way that you made decisions. You know, I give the example, I am previously married. I have a child. I'm divorced now. I get along with my ex-spouse and I'm very lucky. She is a good woman and she didn't stop being a good woman when we got divorced.
Mm-hmm.
But when we were married, a decision will come up and, because by virtue of our jobs, her job was a little more flexible. And so she was able to go in more often with our son to go see the doctor. And so, you know, the fifth ear infection happens in a season. And the doctor looks at her and says, okay, it's time for tubes in the ears. And so, and then she would make the appointment and then come back to me that night and says, this is what happened. Eli, our son needs tubes.
Mm-hmm.
And then the pause. So what's happened in that moment? You know, technically we have joint custody. We make those decisions together. But the reality of it is that my then wife made a decision that my son was going to get tubes and then kind of checked in with me to make sure I don't, didn't have problems with it. I'm not saying that in a way to be critical, but that's how we made that decision.
That's how it just has to be sometimes.
That's how it was. And so we get divorced. Do you think that's going to change? fathers come to me often all the time and are concerned about gender bias in court decisions. Oh, the woman always gets custody or a woman always gets that. And I say to them, that decision was made by you and your wife years before you came to see me.
Sure.
And why will we, barring anything, recent developments, barring changes in either your or your spouse's life that would want us to then revisit that, we're not going to change how you made those decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And so ultimately, someone made the call. Ultimately, the other person was consulted. There are couples that do genuinely make decisions together, but what we ultimately do in divorce cases or paternity cases is we're not going to alter that. And if we can go into the court setting, kind of recognizing that, I think we'll finally get down to the bottom of it.
We need to take a break, but before we do, let's maybe wrap up this part of the discussion by some changes you say are coming or about to take effect here that I believe the legislature passed here not too long ago.
Right. Like I said, there's been changes to the Divorce Act, and one was maintenance, one was child custody, and coming this July is changing how we arrive at child support. Before, the law right now is that the person who pays support, it's a percentage of their net income. And so two children, let's say 28% of your net income, and it's a kind of a guideline that is followed. What we're going to do after July, we're going to make it a lot more complicated. I call it the lawyer full employment program, but it's going to make it much more complicated, in which that we taking a look at both parents' incomes and then following certain set of guidelines on what basically with that joint income, how much would it take to raise a child in that lifestyle, and then dividing it as a equal shares or shares of that based on income, it's going to be complicated. It's going to ideally be fairer.
I was going to say, yeah, complicated but equitable.
More equitable. Yeah. I mean, in the respect that, you know, let's say you have a father who is a faculty, you know, a minimum wage person, but you have the mother who's a doctor, and the child is residing with mother. It will result in circumstances under these guidelines where that perhaps the mother will be paying the non-principal parent money. Mm-hmm. But it's going to be fairer ultimately. But it's going to make it a lot more complicated for people to try to arrive at that. I fully expect that every single one of my former divorce cases and paternity clients
going to come back
and come on in and say, how does this affect me? You know, either side, either as the parent with the majority parenting time or the parent who is the payor, you know.
And I imagine the answer is, well, you signed this agreement, so it doesn't really affect you.
Well, you know, what the law says is that the change in the statute is not a basis on which to come back and make a change in child support. But what it will invariably, you know, after 2 years that has passed, people's incomes have changed. And so it'll be an opportunity to look at it again. And but, you know, we're not going to be able to tell people until we know the other person's income.
Sure.
So you kind of have to dive in and see how it works out.
All right. We need to take one final break. And then another important issue you were telling me is coming up regarding wills. And
sure.
We'll talk about that. And if you have questions, 342-9194 is our number for Attorney Jeremy Carlin, my guest this hour on Galesburg Live. It's 8:53. We'll be back in a moment.
Ask the expert during Galesburg Live. Got a question? Call 342-9194 now or email WGIL@WGIL.com.
We're in the final, actually, minute. We have a little bit more than a minute of time with Attorney Jeremy Carlin. Jeremy, I'm really glad you came in today. We got a lot of interesting issues here dealt with.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I think the last thing we want to talk about in our last 45 seconds is things we don't like to talk about, which is death.
And I'm only 28 years old, Jeremy. All right, not really, but is that sort of the period with which you should start thinking about that sort of thing?
I don't know. Do you work out and eat healthily?
No.
Well, then yes. For the most part, frankly, you know, none of us are Rockefellers. I guess by saying Rockefeller, I'm dating myself. But very few of us are like Bill Gates. And yeah. So people ask me, you know, listen, I don't have a lot of money. Do I need a will? And the answer is typically what brings people to me is when they have kids. If you have children, then you do need a will, because that will direct what happens to your child, or help direct what happens to your child upon your passing, or you and your spouse's passing, as well as what happens to your assets. But also what we want as a part of any type of estate planning process, we do some advanced planning, which is we're not only just talking about the situation if you were to pass, but also if you were to be incapacitated and then you couldn't make decisions, financial or medical decisions on your own. Given the privacy laws that we have in place, it's very difficult. It would be very difficult for my insurance company, for example, to speak to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
So I need to designate. Someone in a living will, in a power of attorney, who can speak to my bank, who can speak to my insurance company, who can speak and make some decisions for me. Should I not be able to do that? And as a part of any estate planning process, we do that for people.
Real quickly, how can folks get a hold of you if they want more help with that?
If they want more help with that, it can be reached at Barash and Everett at 309-341-6010. And we're at www.barashandeverett.com. www.barashlaw.com.
Jeremy Carlin, attorney, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Will.
It's 9 o'clock. Have a great day. This has been Galesburg Live on WGIL.